When I was 3 years old, my parents and I went with some family friends to a cabin up in the mountains. One of the other family's kids was sick with some sort of flu. A few nights in, I came down with it and threw up everywhere, over and over. My father was so grossed out that his reaction made me cry. A lot. My mom had to kick him out of the room while she took care of me. His horrified expression imprinted in my mind forever and taught me that there's something terribly wrong with being sick. I'm 28 years old now, and I spent years of my life being absolutely paranoid about throwing up. Emetophobia controls so much of a person's existence. It makes you afraid to share someone's drink, afraid to eat without washing your hands, afraid to get on roller coasters, afraid to fly in planes, afraid to try new things. But at some point after decades with that phobia, you almost forget what causes you to regard all of those things with fear. The possibility of vomiting becomes subconscious. You don't even think about it anymore. You're just afraid of virtually everything that could cause it. And yet you have no immediate explanation for why you're afraid anymore. You just are. Although that possibility no longer lingers at the precipice of my consciousness, the imposter found it. He went straight to the core of my being and saw what terrifies me the most. He brought it out and used it against me. Repeating Nathan's spiritual purge chant didn't just disable me there in the field, it was a reminder. A reminder of the creature's remarkable power to turn my own flawed humanity upon me. A reminder that it was planning to make me suffer in the most personal of ways. The imposter was designing a personal hell for me, and was nearly ready to drag me down into it. And so the world collapsed on me. I laid there on the ground, puking my guts out, knowing that my fiancé was asleep and unguarded in bed while a terrible being strode towards her through the dark. It called out her name in every voice familiar to her. It said things that would make her happy. It begged for help and mimicked the cries of children. It capitalized on her innate motherly instincts, on her buried memories, and on the vulnerabilities of her subconscious state. And all I could do was stagger around and wait for the thrum of my death-gripped heart to subside. After a few moments, moonlight poured back into my vision, lighting the way out of the park. My pulse recovered from its frenzy and the numbness of my limbs faded. The taste in my mouth for once didn't paralyze me. I tore through the streets to get back to my house. I had no plan. A lot of lights were on in the houses that lined my street. Many of my neighbors had likely heard me screaming. I hoped this meant that the imposter would think twice about moving out in the open beneath their watchful gazes. The front door of my house was wide open, and it was pitch black inside. I shouted for Faye, but I couldn't find her. The bed was emptied and disheveled, as though she'd jumped out of it or had been dragged out of it. A faint sound caught my attention, the sound of crying. I struggled to determine where it came from, and after looking in every room, I realized it was coming from outside. I stepped out the sliding glass door in our bedroom that leads to the backyard. The sound grew louder and mixed with shuffling noises. There's a walkway that runs along the side of our house and connects the backyard to the front. And there in the darkness was Faye. She was sleepwalking in the most unusual manner I'd ever seen. She stood high on the balls of her feet as before, but was bent over at the waist. Her hair and arms dangled lifelessly towards the ground, and she shuffled towards the street where I'd first seen the shadowy figure. Faye's neck was craned in such a way that I could see her face swaying just outside her left thigh. Two mournful eyes peered up at me from it. Her lips trembled as she cried. I couldn't tell if she was conscious or not. She mumbled something, but with her cries, I couldn't make out what she was saying. I wrapped my arms around her waist and literally carried her inside. She clawed at me and landed a tiger palm to my crotch. Just as we careened into the living room, a police car drifted by, its flashlights tracing all across the houses. I gently closed the door and peered out the window. Took me a moment to see it. But in the tree, in our front yard, a dark form was crouched on the thickest branch. I yanked the curtains down over the blinds. Faye and I remained awake the rest of the night until dawn. We heard footsteps in our roof and in the attic, but no voices. On two occasions, someone knocked gently on the front door, and once on the sliding glass door in the back. But we remained in the living room. We communicated only through pen and paper, and prevented each other from nodding off and dreaming about the scrapbook or about Christopher. The last thing she wrote was, "Got an idea. Explain tomorrow." At about 6 a.m., my cell phone buzzed on the table. All had been quiet for a few hours now, and Faye and I were almost done with the second Lord of the Rings movies when I grabbed my phone. I was surprised to see that it was the ranger from Pike's Peak. His name is Greg, same as Faye's dad, so I just refer to him by title. We hadn't spoken in a while, and I immediately feared that his call was confirmation of the grim likelihood that Nathan was dead. He skipped all pleasantries and said, "You better sit down." A nauseous fear crept up my throat when he said that. I shook my head and replied, just tell me. Static began to form around my peripheral vision, which happens when I'm feeling faint. If it grows and covers my entire field of view, I'll pass out. The ranger cleared his throat and tried to speak with composure, but I could hear in his voice that he'd been crying. He said, "We got a call from Nathan's relatives. Said he'd been missing for a few days. Thought he was camping out with his buddies, but none of them knew where he was. On my routine this morning, I dropped by Faye's folks' cabin." There was a long silence, which told me everything I needed to know, but then the ranger said more. "We got cops everywhere up here now. Whole mountain's shut down. They've got T-Way listed as a missing person, but now they're out hunting for a body, like they mean it this time. Looking for a murderer too," but I interrupted him and demanded to know why. There was no way I could hide the frantic anxiety any longer. "The ranger said something's happening up here, up at the cabin. They did something to him. I don't know how to tell you." He paused again, struggling to hold back tears. I crumpled to the floor while he spoke. The news singed every nerve in my body. Pain radiated from my stomach across every limb. My scalp tingled. The static grew in my vision. "I need to know," I said. The ranger insisted that the details were unnecessary, but I begged him. "What I'm about to tell you is a paraphrasing of what the ranger said. Some of this info might change as the Denver coroner performs an official autopsy, but this is what we know." The bathroom window of the cabin had been forced open from the outside, but also the front door was unlocked and slightly open when the ranger arrived. The bedroom door was locked from the inside. It appeared that two people, one of them being Nathan, had been staying inside the cabin for two or three nights. Nathan's satellite phone was found inside, my number being the last one dialed. It was unclear whether Nathan was present at the cabin when we last spoke, when he promised he wouldn't go to the cabin. There was a buck knife jammed into one of the walls, and many unusual symbols and words had been carved all over the hallway, leading from the living room to the bedroom. There were words in Hopi, the language of Nathan's people, and Zuni, a language they did not speak. The words haven't yet been translated. There was a carving of a large dream catcher on the outside of the bedroom door. A non-lethal amount of blood spattered on the carpet and lower wall opposite of said door. On the inside of the bedroom door, there were small marks everywhere, as though someone had been pounding very hard on it. The ranger and sheriff speculated that Nathan sat on the floor in the hallway for several hours or perhaps an entire day. Someone was in the bedroom, but the door remained locked. It's possible that they had a long conversation. At no point was the electricity or heat functioning in the cabin because it had been shut off after I was rescued on my second visit. This meant that however long Nathan stayed, he remained in the dark in freezing weather each night. Two pairs of tracks were found leaving the cabin, one from the bedroom window, the other from the front door. heading into the forest out back. The tracks joined together, indicating the two people walked side by side into the woods. Nathan's body was found by the ranger's dogs approximately a quarter mile in, buried upside down, with his legs erupting from the soil at the knee. Upon exhumation, it was discovered that Nathan's face and scalp had been flayed or mutilated. There were deep lacerations in his back that appeared to be from claws and carvings on his arm that looked like self-inflicted. The unofficial cause of death, however, was suffocation. He had been buried alive. Oh, and everything in the cellar was gone. It was completely empty. I've never come so close to ending my own life. The guilt and horror I felt at hearing the ranger's words are still ineffable, so I won't bother trying to document them. Somehow I convinced myself that there would be a time for grieving in the future and even for acts of penance, but right now I need to focus on Faye. After all, she might end up like Nathan and T-Way if we didn't figure out what to do. A few days passed with no strange activity beyond a voice here and there. I was hesitant to let Faye sleep, for fear that she would dream of her little brother and give the imposter what it sought. But she explained to me her idea, a plan to get rid of the creature once and for all, and for the first time in months, I actually felt a glimmer of hope. I kept drinking Nathan's tea after concluding that it was doing no discernible harm, and Faye spent the day furiously drawing, journaling, texting with her mom and sister. I called Angela and the Shishon woman, requested that she come visit us with her hypnotist friend again to speak with Faye and to bless our new home. I also made a large donation that I could afford to Tiwi and Nathan's community to help cover the cost of their funeral ceremonies. In my spare time in the evenings, I wrote a letter for both of them, and I intend to read it at their place of burial someday. Each night, Faye went to bed crying. She had definitely entered some kind of mourning process, long delayed by years of denial, and I now bore witness to the lifelong impact of her loss. Never have I seen a human in so much pain. But Faye assured me that she would be all right, and I should have faith in her. I silently obliged because I trust her more than anyone in the world. She knows herself, and I put my faith in that. One night, I snuck into the bedroom and retrieved Faye's drawings. She had produced several pictures of her own nightmares, of memories from her childhood, and of a young man that looked like her. I believe he's Christopher, at least. How Faye imagines he might look, had he survived and grown up. She wrote all kinds of things around the drawing, mostly detailed descriptions of the images, sometimes stories from when she was young, and wrote her brother's name dozens of times. She even drew a family portrait that included herself at age 5, holding a smiling baby. On the 5th night after the incident in the park, Angela and her hypnotist friend arrived. As I've mentioned before, I haven't given the hypnotist a name because I just don't want you to have to keep track of too many people. Faye informed our guests of what she believed she could do to get rid of the entity for good. I went outside and set the drawings under the tree in our front yard, where I'd last seen the shadowy figure. Then we got Faye comfortable and set her up on the couch. Fortunately for us, Faye has the remarkable ability of being able to fall asleep anytime, any place. So all we had to do was dim the lights in the house. We made a pasta dish for everyone, and within half an hour, she was out cold. And this time, she didn't drink Nathan's tea. For a long time, Angela, the hypnotist, and I sat at the kitchen table over coffee and ice cream. We kept our voices low and discussed all the recent events related to the cabin, waiting for the imposter to show up. The hypnotist was especially interested in the dreamcatchers and wanted to know who made them. I told her I didn't have any idea, and that at first I thought the entity itself created them. After speaking with all of you, who seem to be a little bit more insightful than I am, I started to believe that someone had summoned or was controlling the entity with the original Dreamcatcher. And then when I broke it, I realized it was protecting me. She said, "Do you think it's possible one of her family members created it? Or the Ranger? You trust him?" Many people have speculated that T-Way and Nathan were not honest with me, or not who they said they were. But I honestly hadn't considered the Ranger himself could be behind all of this. I conceded that it was possible. They spoke a few times in her sleep. She laughed and said things like, "You need help with that? And, what the hell are you doing?" After she said the name of her boss, I realized she was dreaming about work. We waited until midnight, but by then, no activity had occurred, and no sounds were coming from outside. Angela woke Faye up and said, "We need to take a more direct approach." The two women propped Faye up hospital bed style and began to hum a beautiful song. Angela intermittently spoke in her native tongue and traced lines with her finger across Faye's forehead. The hypnotist occasionally raised her hands in the air and then touched Faye's shoulders. After several minutes, my fiancé went limp. Her head slumped back on the couch and her arms dangled to the floor. Finally, she opened her eyes, which were now rolled back in her head, and she began breathing rhythmically. "Who are you?" the hypnotist said. She replied simply, "Hey? Are you alone?" "I'm with you." "Who else is here?" "Angela. Felix. Erica." Erica's her boss. The hypnotist corrected Faye and said, "Erica isn't here. It's just us four." Faye looked puzzled for a moment and then said, "Okay." Angela joined the conversation and touched Faye's arm. She asked, "The one who follows you, the one who calls out in the night, where is he now? Is he here?" Faye's head craned from side to side like she was emptying water from her ears. And then said, "No. Where is he?" Faye sat motionless for what felt like a whole minute and then finally said, "Across the dark." The hypnotist then said, "Faye, can you call out to him? Can you ask him to come here?" She remained silent. The hypnotist asked again. Faye said forcefully, "No." Angela said, "Honey, we can't get rid of him unless you bring him here." Faye began to whimper. Her mouth trembled, and she uttered in the voice of a small child, "Please, no." Goosebumps rippled across my arms as I sat and watched. Angela implored, and Faye began to cry. "You have to call out to him," the hypnotist repeated. "Tell him where you are." Faye slowly rocked her head back and forth and tried to reach up into the air to protect herself. But the weight of her hypnotic state kept her in place. Suddenly, her body went stiff and her eyes rolled forward. They landed squarely on me and then looked over my shoulder and focused on something 1,000 miles behind me. Her mouth opened slightly and gurgling sounds came out from her throat. She said in a wet and masculine voice, "Achoo, achoo." Faye leapt off the couch and shuddered as though she was trying to throw something off of her back. Her body stayed rigid and she turned and faced away from us. Every joint in her limbs popped with a sickening crack. She bent her head back and stared at the same place where the ceiling met the wall in front of her and then tightly balled her fists. She again said, "Watch you." The hypnotist and Angela were standing now, gathering around Faye to prevent her from hurting herself or dashing off into the night. I played safety a few feet away, trying to be ready for anything. The hypnotist said, "Faye, tell us where he is." She breathed hard through gritted teeth and then forced out the words, "Bedroom." We all turned and looked behind us, down the dark hallway. The hypnotist wrapped her hand around Faye's forehead from behind and started whispering in her ear. I turned and quietly moved down the hall towards the bedroom. As I approached it, I could hear the sliding glass door to the yard open. When I stepped into our bedroom, a cold breeze was blowing into it. The glass door on the opposite wall was wide open. I looked around to make sure I wasn't about to get ambushed, and then approached the door. The backyard light had a motion sensor that automatically activates when something moves. It was off and the yard was dark. However, at the far end of the yard, I could make out the shape of a man. Same figure I'd seen a week earlier. The one I'd made the dire mistake of chasing away. This time, the figure was even larger than before. It appeared to stand at roughly 7 feet tall. It faced away as always, and its head was cocked towards the moon. Its hands lay pressed against its sides, fists balled, tightly clutching many pieces of paper, face drawing. It growled,
"Oh my, oh my."
I slid the door shut as fast as I could, and I locked it and raced back to the living room. Faye was now sitting on the couch, head still craned up towards the ceiling, with Angela and the hypnotist speaking to her. They implored her to wake up, but it seemed as though she was struggling to return. Outside, a voice howled. It sounded like a little girl crying out for her mother. Another voice erupted. Laura shouting, "Greg, we need to take her to a hospital!" They began to convulse, so the two women clutched her tightly and begged her to wake up. An infant began to shriek in the yard, and then it slowly moved down the side of the house to the front door. There was a loud, slow knock, followed by more voices. The knock repeated over and over, and Becca's voice called out from beyond the door, "Faye, where are you? Help me. Please. Help." At last, Faye sucked in a huge breath and leaned back on the couch. Her head returned to normal positions, and she stood up, frantically trying to collect herself. The pounding on the door grew louder, and the voices began to overlap as though several people were standing in front of our house, crying out into the night. She said breathlessly, "It's here. It's here," and looked at me. In Faye's eyes, I saw uncertainty and terror, mirrors of my own state, but then a look of conviction fell over her face. The fear seemed to evaporate right off of it. A man began to cry just outside the door. It said in Greg's voice, "It was my child too, Laura. My son. Did you think a weekend in the goddamn mountains would make me forget?" I gasped. His words were so perfectly clear that I nearly believed he was on the other side of the door. "Don't you fucking dare!" Laura's voice shouted. "Don't let her forget! Let her forget! This doesn't have to be her burden too!" Faye burst into tears and wobbled to the door. She rested her face against it and reached for the knob. The shrieks of a baby echoed through the house, followed by the little girl saying, "What's your name? Can I see you? It's Faye. Faye." I watched my fiancé collapse onto the floor in despair. Angela and the hypnotist took a step forward, but Faye put her hand in the air to halt them. She sat on the ground, leaned back against the door, and brushed the strawberry locks out of her face. The door knocked again. My own voice followed it, saying, May I come in? It's freezing out here. Another storm's coming tonight." "I have to tell you something," Faye said, gently knocking on the door. "I know what you really want." The voices fell silent all at once, and only an uneven breathing remained. "I had a baby brother," she said. "His name was Christopher. He was number 5. Breathing cut out. They knocked on the door again. After a minute, something knocked back. "I remember now," she continued. "I couldn't remember for years. I guess I didn't want to. It's easier for me to just pretend things never happen. Some kids make things exist. Friends, monsters, places. But I made Christopher not exist. That way I didn't have to lose him. His death was just make-believe. A long, slow scratching noise resounded through the door. The thing outside was dragging a claw against the wood like it was drawing a picture. Faye put her palm to the door, feeling the weak vibrations of the scratching. For a long time, the number was all I could remember. I knew it meant something more. But every time I thought about it, my whole body would hurt. I'd feel sick. And then I'd just fall asleep. Or if I was dreaming, I'd just wake up. I always knew it meant something more. The door knob rattled and a wet clunk sound emitted from it. The imposter was gnawing on it. From the other side, the clatter of 100 jagged teeth rose in vile symphony across our living room. He's stillborn. Do you know what that is? He died inside my mom. All this time, I've avoided burying Christopher. But you finally helped me realize why it's time I laid him to rest. Faye, come hold him, Faye's voice called out. I don't get it. He falls asleep so fast when you've got him. You want her to be your new mommy, Caleb? The scratching noises persisted. Faye wiped tears out of her eyes and took a deep breath. Now you know everything. I wanted you to know. A chorus of voices ran out into the night, an infant screaming, a toddler cried, Greg and Laura and Becca and T-Way and Nathan and the Ranger all spoke at once. Decades of pain washed through the door, words of anguish and sorrow, cries drowned out all other sounds in the room. Angela, the hypnotist, and I exchanged terrified glances, but Faye remained motionless at the door, staring up into my eyes. She didn't blink. The knocking on the door swelled into violent pounding. The entity used every possible trick it could. It tried to hit her right where the wounds were fresh. It tried to tear open the oldest scars, but Faye never budged. She held her ground emotionally and never took her eyes off of me. They were filled with knowing and calm, as if to say, enough. And the imposter got no response. It stomped from the front door to the nearby window. It towered over us and blocked out the moonlight that lit up the drapes. A huge shadow fell across Faye as she sat there, unmoved.
Oh my,
he growled. Faye's lips quivered, but she said nothing. A titanic scream erupted from the creature, and it slapped the glass with open palms. The sound shook our home and struck a lightning bolt of terror in the pit of my stomach, but Faye did not react. She didn't even flinch. Then the entity said something I didn't expect. Instead of assuming the voice of someone we knew, it spoke in several I didn't recognize. It spoke only one labored sentence, but each word was uttered in a different tongue.
I walked 1,000
years across
the dark
to find you. A part of me wanted to run away screaming. But I was so afraid my legs wouldn't even move. The finality, the longest of what it said, was incomprehensibly dreary. I totally lost my nerve. That moment, another thing even less expected happened. The shadow receded from the window, coloring Faye's face silver with a dim kiss of moonlight. Sullen footsteps lurched across our yard and vanished into the backdrop of cricket songs. After a while, we were alone. All three of us looking down at Faye, a relieved smile across her face. She wasn't crying anymore. It's been several days since the imposter left. He returned once, only to sing the morose lullaby. Sol mi adu, I'm a naked soul. Mi adu. They slept through it entirely. I didn't mention it to her. My fiancé has been sleeping well since that night. She hasn't talked at all and certainly hasn't sleepwalked. In fact, she hasn't even really been tossing or turning like she normally does. It's as if a dreadful weight's been lifted from her shoulders. During the days, she cries. She cuddles with me and talks about her childhood. She Skypes with her mom and sister. And they cry too. I've shed many tears with her. And for her loss. But I understand now what she did. Faye never dreamed of Christopher. Only of the number 5. As a child, she repressed the memory and pain of his loss and thus forgot about him. That number became the lockbox in which he was hidden. It was the coffin she buried him in, and she buried him so deep within herself that she couldn't even remember him in her nightmares. That's why the entity never fully understood what she was hiding. That's why it never gained full access to her. Pei's lifelong sleep disturbances were her mind's attempts at keeping that welling pain repressed. But by talking in her sleep, she invited dark attention to herself. If you speak long enough into the void, something is bound to start listening. Someone or something heard Faye's pain and saw it as a weakness. It saw those cracks in her heart as a passage into her soul. And so it chose her. The imposter became transfixed with my fiancé, not because she was an easy target, but because she was a monolithic puzzle box of torment. A challenge. A worthy opponent. I remarked early on in these stories that one of the things I love most about Faye is her intelligence. She has an artistic creativity that allows her to see things in ways that I do not. She realized that the imposter knew it could tug on her puppet strings by delving into the darkest parts of her mind. In all those hidden places, there were weapons to use against her. To weaken her. To wear her down. But instead of burying her secrets deeper, she unearthed them. She brought them into the light. By moving Christopher and the number that represented him from her subconscious into her waking thoughts, Faye unleashed a tidal wave of forgotten pain upon herself. But also she took away the imposter's power over her. She cut her own puppet strings. And now there was nothing left for the creature to grab onto. So it left. I've also shed tears for my dear friends, T.O.A. and Nathan. Perhaps I can never convey the warmth of their personalities and the sincerity of their hearts, but I trust them entirely. I do not believe that they'll have anything to do with the foul thing that stalked my fiancé for all these years. Their deaths are mortal wounds on my heart, and I will always carry the agony of their loss. I want it to hurt. It's a permanent reminder. They've given so much to me and asked nothing in return, only that I preserve the goodness of their people in my memory. By writing about their altruism and sacrifices, I'm trying to fulfill that promise. May their spirits live on in the sacred land they protected. We may never know for sure who built the dreamcatcher at the cabin, or the one in the trees outside my old home. Right now, I believe they were built by different people who live in Pike's Peak. Some of them want to protect fools like me who venture to the mountain without understanding its significance to the people who live there. Others perhaps wish to harm them. Maybe even Angela herself built one for us. Maybe you can't tell the person they're designed to protect, or else it doesn't work. Faye's ring had also been the topic of a heated debate, whether or not it's cursed, what should be done with it, etc. And for now, my fiancé doesn't wish to part with it, but she might consider it if anything happens again. It's still a precious family heirloom and the symbol of my devotion, whatever taint it may carry. I guess what I mean is we still don't have all the answers. And the unfortunate thing is that we may never. The true nature of the entity and a full explanation of what happened to us might remain a mystery, but in time, I believe I'll come to understand more about this terrible ordeal. We plan to head back to Colorado in a few days to spend time with Faye's parents, to pay our deepest respects to Tiwe and Nathan's communities, and to witness the bulldozing of the cabin. Whatever secrets it still hides, let them be buried deep beneath the rubble and the snow of decades to come. Thank you.